You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, October 24th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, folks. How are you doing tonight?
Where's Bob?
Oh.
Bob's running late, but he will join us later in the show, or so he claims. We'll see.
I thought we were just going to sneak him in by the magic of editing.
Nah, screw him.
He's here the whole time. We've done really, it before. You know, you guys don't even know.
That's true.
Bob has only shown up actually for three shows.
That's
Bob
right.
Bob is actually a complicated ventriloquism project that Steve's underwent.
Very successful. Very successful.
Are you saying that Bob's a baboon, Steve?
Oh, man.
Oh, have a heart.
Oh, man.
Terrible, terrible.
It's going to be that kind of show tonight.
Are you saying that Bob is monkeying around?
Just going to open up another beer here. Hold on. Okay. Hey, so...
Speaking of baboon hearts,
speaking what do you know about
having
Bob?
No segue on this happens to be the 30th anniversary of when baby Faye became the first infant recipient of an organ from a non-human animal. And it was, in fact, a baboon heart. It was known as a xenotransplant. And these are extraordinarily rare, but that was the first one done on an infant. And when I was researching this, I actually found it so interesting that I did a whole YouTube video about it. So you can, because I knew we wouldn't have time to go into all the details on this, but it's fascinating. So you could check out that if you want more, but let me give you guys the outline. So baby Faye was born with a condition where the left side of her heart was underdeveloped. And so the right side had to do all of the heavy lifting of pumping blood through her body, which isn't sustainable. So most babies who are born with the syndrome, it's hypoplastic left heart syndrome, end up dying after about 10 days or so if the condition's left untreated. And so baby Faye's doctor, Dr. Leonard L. Bailey at the Loma Linda University Medical Center, told her parents that baby Faye's best option was to receive this transplant of a baboon heart. So they agreed. They did the surgery. And 20 days later, baby Faye died, which is obviously horribly tragic. But at the same time, he effectively doubled her life expectancy. So from Dr. Bailey's point of view, this was a moderate success. And about a year later, he went on to perform one of the first, if not the first, regular transplants, heart transplants into a newborn baby.
And you mean human to human?
Human to human. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
So that's the story as it is. But at the time, there was a ton of controversy. Animal rights activists were annoyed because animals were being killed for human organs. That's the future that this was proposing. Also, there was a big to-do over whether or not the parents had any right to agree to undergo this risky operation on their infant. Do they have the right to make that decision for another person?
Sure.
So that, that was an argument that was being hashed out at the time. And another controversy was whether or not the parents were fully informed at the time of the surgery. And a lot of the evidence suggests that the answer is no, they were not fully informed as to all of the risks. It turns out that Dr. Bailey told them in the consent form that baby Faye's parents signed, it states that surgeries that were used at the time to correct the hypoplastic left heart syndrome were largely unsuccessful at extending the life of the child. But that was incorrect. There was a surgeon who had been performing those operations with a lot of success since 1979. And the consent form also said that Dr. Bailey had done tons of surgeries that on animals, showing that xenotransplants could be very effective at extending the lifespan of the baby, which again was untrue. He had performed 160 xenotransplants on mostly goats and sheep, and none of them survived more than 6 months. And then the kicker, you guys are going to love this. When journalists later asked the doctor why he chose a baboon heart instead of the heart of a species that was closer to humans, evolutionarily speaking, Dr. Bailey said, "I don't believe in evolution."
What?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the entire thing was one large F up, basically. It's really tragic because, you know, it resulted in the death of this newborn baby who could have had a shot at life. There are adults today that were born with hypoplastic left heart syndrome, you know, who are now in their 30s and are doing very well thanks to the surgeries that were developed by doctors who understood things like evolution and consent forms and things.
Yeah, right. And ethics.
Yeah, and actually managed to create a way of treating the condition that would result in more lives saved. So,
not that there's anything wrong with xenotransplants. There have been a couple of baboon liver transplants.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only xeno heart transplant that I think the controversy here killed it. Bailey had planned to do a series of 5 transplants in like the first series, but he never got past the first one because of the controversy that was created about it. He also didn't put the baby Faye on the heart transplant list, even though infant hearts were not really available at the time. It was kind of a... would have been a formality.
Actually, I read a source that said that there was an infant heart available at the time.
Is that right? But he acknowledged he should have put her on the waiting list.
Yeah, he didn't even bother to look for one.
Yeah, a little bit too anxious there to get going with this study.
Mm-hmm.
I also read that that baby Faye's heart didn't have that much rejection, so she died of some other reason, probably not an infection, but the rejection itself wasn't that bad, but they still didn't know why she died.
Well, apparently baboons and humans don't share any antigens, making it next to impossible to actually match a baboon to a human.
Oh, yeah. No, it's totally impossible. But they were saying that wasn't why she died so quickly. It wasn't because her tissue was being rejected.
Yeah.
The rejection was only mild. But I don't know. Maybe that was being a little optimistic there. Yeah. You know, so yeah, even 30 years later, I mean, you know, the notion is still out there, you know, of breeding animals, altering animals, genetically modifying them, whatever that, so that they would actually have organs that could then be harvested for transplantation. It's actually not a bad idea, in my opinion, if we could pull it off technically.
There is research going on. It doesn't seem to be incredibly popular just because allotransplants seem to have a lot more potential,
mm-hmm.
at least according to the people who are funding the studies. So that seems to be where all of the money's going.
But there aren't enough organs out there for all the people who need them. That's the problem.
Yeah. There's no reason to not check that little box when you get your driver's license and become an organ donor. Everybody should do it. You're not going to use them. Well, Jay thinks he's going to use them, but you're not going to use them. Check the box.
Just get your head frozen and then donate the rest of your organs.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'll grow you a new body later.
Yeah.
Love to think that in 40 years or so that, you know, technology would have advanced to the point where, you know, there's a possibility, right?
Of which?
What?
Of cryonics.
Yeah, but we're not going to get into that discussion
right now.
Instead, Jay, you're going to tell us about PPMOs.
PPMOs. It actually sounds like you're about to say something weird or silly, but no.
Yeah.
Before we get there, let me just give a little background here. So this is a news item about a new antibacterial, but I want to give a little background on what antibacterials are.
They kill bacteria, right?
They do. They are fully against bacteria. They go to war with bacteria for us. You know, antibacterials are incredible. They're a powerful drug in today's arsenal of all the treatments that we have, you know, that people receive. Antibacterials are massively effective, widely used, and have saved millions of lives and improved the quality of a lot of people's lives as well.
Can I ask a question? Who here knows somebody who would be dead without antibiotics?
I do.
Oh, yeah.
I do.
Multiple Definitely. People.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. One of my children might be dead without antibiotics.
Sure.
Ay, ay, ay.
However, the downside to antibacterials is that many dangerous bacteria have grown resistant to them, right? Remember there was a scare that our current antibacterials are losing their power and, you know, in the future, what are we going to do? And today's antibiotics work by disrupting a bacteria's cellular function. Antibiotics can come with other side effects that we don't want. They can vary from fever, nausea, major allergic reactions, something called photodermatitis, which is being, you know, sensitive to light. And, you know, these are things, all of these things are terrible. And, you know, a lot of people might not realize that you can get all these different symptoms from an antibiotic.
Jay, for completeness, let me mention a couple of things. So you mentioned that antibiotics kill bacteria. Actually, a lot of antibiotics just keep them from reproducing. So there are bactericidal antibiotics that kill bacteria, but there's a lot of bacteriostatic antibiotics. So, you know, if the bacteria can't reproduce, that just gives your immune system an opportunity to wipe them out so they can't spread.
That's cool. So on October 15th of this year, 2013, research was published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases by researchers at Oregon State University or Oregon State University, the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, and Sarpeta, Inc., regarding a new class of antibacterials called PPMOs. So this stands for, prepare yourself for massive mispronunciation, peptide conjugated photophorodiamatite morpholino oligomerlin animal studies. What is that, Steve?
Okay.
Yeah. Sum that up.
Yeah. So it's, you got the peptide conjugated, correct?
Thank you. Those are the shortest words in that whole sentence.
So that'd be phosphoradiamidate morpholino oligomer.
All right. You just made those words up.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway,
of course he did.
PPMOs tested very well against Acinetobacter. And this is a serious and deadly group of bacteria that has a very high death rate. They are commonly spread in hospitals and they're a global threat. Typically, they cause respiratory infections and sepsis. And they also are deadly to anyone who has a compromised immune system. In many cases, PPMOs were far more effective than existing antibiotics, and they were found effective against bacteria that has become resistant to our current suite of antibiotics. Human testing has not begun. They are testing PPMOs on other animals. And what makes them even more interesting is the fact that they fight bacteria in a completely different way. And this is actually what we were waiting for. We were waiting for a brand new approach. What they do is they disrupt a bacteria's genes. So they're a synthetic analog of DNA or RNA, and they can neutralize the expression of specific genes. Bruce Geller, a professor of microbiology at OSU College of Science and lead author on the study, said the mechanism that PPMOs use to kill bacteria is revolutionary. They can be synthesized to target almost any gene and in that way avoid the development of antibiotic resistance and the negative impacts sometimes associated with broad spectrum antibiotics. So that being said, they are custom tailor creating these PPMO drugs to fight specific bacteria. And they're attacking them by attacking the DNA and the RNA of certain bacteria, which means that it's such a specifically targeted medication that it doesn't do a lot of other things in the system. They are supposed to be a lot safer and a lot easier to easier for your body to deal with. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, they're very specifically targeted. They go after one gene, and we could choose what gene that is to make sure it's not one that the bacteria share with humans. And also,
like Gene Bukowski lives down the street from me. Sure.
Also, Jay, did you come across and you're reading that these PPMOs are being used to treat more than just bacterial infections? They could be used to treat genetic diseases because you can target them against an abnormal mutant gene that creates a protein where the abnormal protein is part of the disease, is part of the problem. You can block the production of these abnormal proteins.
Yeah, I thought that was even more interesting than the antibacterial aspect, Steve, because
yeah.
They're going to be able to – this is the beginning of them custom tailoring, you know, medications to treat specific diseases and ailments or whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, just any time where you can block a gene and that can have an effect that you want, you know, this is a potential treatment. However, regarding the bacterial resistance, because, in reading about the PPMOs as antibiotics, it did say that this would be a solution to resistance. But in doing research, I found papers showing that there's resistance to PPMOs.
Oh, come on!
So,
Well,
think about it. If the PPMO is targeting a specific sequence on a gene, a mutation in that sequence can then make it lose its specificity. But then couldn't we just make a PPMO against the new mutation?
Yeah, we could.
Without
but we
limit?
How fast can we whip these out, though? I mean, isn't there quite a bit of research that goes in and everything?
I don't know. I mean, if we automate it to the point where we could, maybe even do a blood culture of you, find out what bug is in your system, manufacture a PPMO right then and there against that strain of that bacteria, that would be the ideal situation, and then kill off that bacteria and that bacteria strain alone in your body. And then if it mutates, just... Or maybe, target a few different gene sequences so one mutation won't cut it. You know, you gotta, you'd have to mutate against all of them. Who knows?
Steve, I have a really good idea. Let's 3D print PPMOs on the spot in your house.
Mm-hmm. That's, you just gave a TED talk right there. That was in and of
itself. Awesome. Yeah, so this is an exciting new technology. There's no doubt about it. Doesn't sound as sexy as like stem cells, but it is. It actually really is. You know, the ability to target specific gene sequences has a tremendous potential. This is a basic technology I think we're going to be hearing about for quite some time. Well, Rebecca, we covered a couple of political-ish news items recently, and before you go into this next item, which is about scientific literacy and political ideology, I do want to say the SGU is an apolitical program. We do not endorse any end of the political spectrum. When we talk about politics, it has to do with its interaction with science, scientific literacy, or a specific scientific issue that we're dealing about. So, with all that in mind, there was a surprising result, if you will, regarding a recent study about scientific literacy and politics.
That's right, Steve. Science says that the government should crumble and we should all live in anarchy forever. So that's the SGU's official endorsement now. Yep.
No. Okay. We are all anarchists.
Yes.
Okay.
No. Okay. So a few days ago, Evan alerted us to a story that was traveling around Tea Party circles, and it had headlines like, Yale professor says Tea Partiers better at science, and Yale study, Tea Party members are more scientifically literate than non-Tea Party members, etc. And all the articles reported that Yale psychology professor Dan Kahan, well known to the SGU audience by now, I hope, proved solidly that Tea Partiers were smarter at science than both Democrats and Republicans. Take that. And most of the articles quoted Kahan as saying, I've got to confess, though, I found this result surprising. As I pushed the button to run the analysis on my computer, I fully expected I'd be shown a modest negative correlation between identifying with the Tea Party and science comprehension. But then again, I don't know a single person who identifies with the Tea Party. All my impressions come from watching cable TV, and I don't watch Fox News very often, and reading the paper, New York Times Daily, plus a variety of politics-focused internet sites like Huffington Post and Politico. I'm a little embarrassed, but mainly I'm just glad that I no longer hold this particular mistaken view. So when I read those articles, I was confused because I had just read Kahan's post on his site, culturalcognition.net, and it wasn't a study. It was just a blog post, which was describing some preliminary findings of some research Kahan is doing. So what happened was Kahan completed a survey where he gauged the scientific literacy of Americans by and then examining that data by looking at the differences between people of differing political persuasions, differing education levels, and differing religiosity levels. And he also did ask if his subjects identified as a member of the Tea Party. And sure enough, when it came to politics, Tea Partiers were more scientifically literate than Democrats and Republicans. But he knew there was a but coming. Here's what those Tea Party posts conveniently left out. Kahan's results showed that liberals were slightly more scientifically literate than conservatives. And Kahan pointed out that while that was a statistically significant result, it was practically insubstantial, especially when it comes to figuring out how we'll solve the problem of politically biased scientific illiteracy. And to prove his point and stop liberals from misusing that data point to bash conservatives, he then went on to mention that he found that the Tea Party members were higher than the liberals. But again, it was almost exactly the same amount. So it was still statistically significant, but again, it was practically useless. So here's a quote from Kahan that the Tea Partiers did not use in their posts. Again, the relationship is trivially small and can't possibly be contributing in any way to the ferocious conflicts over decision-relevant science that we are experiencing. And later he writes, next time I collect data, too, I won't be surprised at all if the correlations between science comprehension and political ideology or identification with the Tea Party movement disappear or flip their signs. These effects are trivially small, and if I sample 2,000 plus people, it's pretty likely any discrepancy I see will be, quote, statistically significant, which has precious little to do with, quote, practically significant. So a few days after the Tea Party blogs flipped out over his original post, Kahan posted an update in which he just completely rages about how his words were twisted to basically advance exactly the opposite of his interpretation of the data. Kahan vehemently states that there is no good evidence to suggest that the differences between political policies has any bearing on the scientific literacy of adherence to the various political parties. In other words, he says that if we want to increase public understanding of things like climate change, we can't have a metaphorical dick measuring contest over which political party is smarter. And he actually does use that metaphor. He doesn't use the word dick. he gives a few really cut and dry takeaways from his research, including this one. Tea Party members are like everyone else, as far as I can tell, when it comes to science comprehension. Is this something to be proud of? I don't think so. It means if we were to select a Tea Party member at random, there would be a 50% chance he or she would say that antibiotics kill viruses as well as bacteria, and less than a 40% chance that he or she would be able to correctly interpret data from a simple experiment involving a new skin rash treatment. He also goes on to refer back to his previous research, which we covered fairly recently here on the SGU. You guys might recall we talked about the study that looked at how those who have more scientific literacy, regardless of their political affiliation, are more likely to engage in politically motivated reasoning using that skin rash treatment test. So, yeah, basically, he's currently in the midst of some interesting research. Some Tea Partiers took it out of context in the way that he had previously found liberals doing with any study mm-hmm. that showed that liberals were more scientifically literate than conservatives. And he absolutely flipped out over it. But it's very entertaining to read Kahan flipping out because he's very intelligent and very, very, very careful. You know, he desperately wants people to understand that his viewpoint, it may not be a viewpoint that we share, that our listeners share, but I think we can appreciate that it's his viewpoint based on the science that he has seen and done, is that it doesn't matter what political party you ascribe to. Our scientific literacy is all pretty much the same, and we have to find different ways of reaching across party lines in order to increase consensus on things like global warming amongst the general public.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about these slight variances. You know, basically everyone has a low level of scientific literacy on average, you know. And so they're arguing about which group of scientifically illiterate Americans are slightly less scientifically illiterate than the other. And that's not the factor here. That's not the big factor. The big factor is motivated reasoning and not using your intelligence because you're ideologically blinkered. That's the problem. It's denialism of science. It's not, I mean, I'm not minimizing scientific literacy as a problem. Obviously, I think if everybody were significantly more scientifically literate, we would be better off. But the differences between liberals and conservatives, tea parties and whatever, is not this sliver of statistical, you know, difference between, you look at the curves, they're almost completely overlapping except for these slight variances. And he makes an interesting point. We actually had a question on this a few weeks ago. Remember about overpowered studies? What does that mean for a study to be overpowered? And he said that in his last paragraph, that he's collecting data on thousands of people. So any slight little difference is probably going to be, you know, statistically significant. And so the overpowered studies will tend to show effects which are irrelevant, are practically insignificant, but they will be statistically significant. And as we discussed previously, I'll just encapsulate very quickly, there's a ton of factors here that he's not looking at with this pre-published, you know, raw data that he's looking at here. There, you know, so many different things. Like, for example, if Tea Party members are just slightly wealthier or more educated on average, that could explain the slight, you know, variance that we're seeing. It doesn't say anything about the relationship between science, attitude toward science, critical thinking, scientific literacy, and any particular ideology.
Yep.
And I think that's been our experience in the, what, better than almost 20 years that we've been you know, exposed in the skeptical community and, you know, science studies and all that, Steve. I think we've, that's kind of been our feel for it over the time.
Our subjective experience. Get it from all sides. Yeah, basically. All right. Let's move on. Evan, you're going to tell us about this new dangerous health scare, wind turbine syndrome.
Dun, dun, dun.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
What? People's ears flopping? Like, what's happening, Evan?
Yeah, so here's what's happening. Several residents of Falmouth, Massachusetts, which is on Cape Cod, have filed lawsuits claiming that three 400-foot-tall, 1.63-megawatt turbines were responsible for an array of adverse health effects. The symptoms being reported by the residents include headaches, tinnitus, insomnia, dizziness, sensations of fluttering in the chest, and that's just to name a few. There's even more than
It's tinnitus.
No, it's tinnitus.
It's not inflammation of anything. It's ringing in the ears, tinnitus.
So all those commercials that I'm hearing on the radio and everywhere are wrong? They're all pronouncing it incorrectly.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
It's tinnitus.
But Steve, if everybody says it wrong, then maybe they're all right.
I mean, okay, officially you'll find that both pronunciations are used and accepted. There's also an English-British difference, I think, in the pronunciation. But I prefer tinnitus because tinnitus sounds like inflammation, and that is misleading. Therefore, tinnitus should be preferred.
Uh-huh.
I thought itis meant heebie-jeebies.
Well, in any case.
Anyway.
So in 2011, a doctor at Harvard Medical School diagnosed one of the residents with something the doctor called wind turbine syndrome. Plaintiffs are seeking anywhere between $150,000 and $300,000 in damages for loss of value of their home and to cover their medical bills. The name wind turbine syndrome was coined by a gal named Nina Pierpont. She's a Johns Hopkins University trained pediatrician. Her husband is an anti-wind activist.
That's just a coincidence, Evan. That has nothing to do with her medical opinions here.
Yeah. And she lives in New York, in upstate New York, and she calls wind turbine syndrome the green energy industry's dirty little secret. She published a book in 2009 called Wind Turbine Syndrome, which included case studies of people who lived within 1.25 miles of these wind turbines, and they reportedly got sick. So, once again, we must step back from all the noise and the anecdotes and the politics and ask ourselves, what's the evidence? What is the evidence which is supporting the claims that wind turbines are the cause of these people's symptoms? So, has this been studied? Yeah, it has, actually. There have been a lot of studies about this. So, modern wind farms have been in use around the world for decades, but only in more recent years, perhaps the last 5 years or so, have human health-related complaints been reported. There have now been 17 reviews of available evidence about wind farms. These are reviews of all studies, not just single pieces of research, and in each of these reviews have concluded that wind turbines can annoy a minority of people in their vicinity, but there's no strong evidence that they make people ill at all. So what else might be going on here? We don't have just like one or two people. We've got, you know, in some communities, dozens of people all claiming to have similar kinds of symptoms. Where have we heard this before? Where have we seen this before?
I don't know. Wi-Fi?
You guys remember? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Wi-Fi illness, the case with students in upstate New York we covered last year. What was their condition, Steve? They
had psychogenic symptoms.
Right, psychogenic symptoms. So these are all examples of what is known as communicated diseases, and it spreads via the nocebo effect. And in fact, they're calling this, or they have called wind turbine syndrome, a textbook example of the nocebo effect. Right, if you believe something bad's going to happen, chances are your brains are going to make it happen.
Or not even that, even simpler, you have non-specific symptoms. For whatever reason, you're not sleeping well, you're depressed, and you look for a specific cause. Maybe it's that big wind turbine I don't like looking at, you know, on the hill over there, or it's all these power lines buzzing overhead, or whatever. Make up your fake cause. And I think that's, responsible for a lot of this.
There is also evidence suggesting that the feedback people get from each other, if you start, you know, two people tell two other people and they start telling other people, then yeah, the symptoms actually will spread because people will start associating whatever little aches, pains, or discomforts that they're experiencing, and they're going to attribute it to, oh, well, it must be the wind turbines that John down the street is experiencing. And it's been proven that this is a real psychological effect that takes place in communities.
And, you know, when you're talking about the choice of target here and what could be causing these nonspecific problems, I think there might be another thing going on here, which I will call NIMBYism. I think they have a severe case of NIMBYitis, or not in my backyard-itis. Because, you know, having lived in Boston during the Cape Wind Project's approval process, it was really astonishing to see the excuses that rich people came up with to prevent the turbines from going in. And this isn't to suggest that there aren't often real concerns about wind turbines and, for instance, their environmental impact. But the arguments against the wind turbines going in where they went in, which was in Nantucket Sound, were primarily things like, this will affect the yachting routes.
Yeah, exactly.
This will lower property values because of, and, but they lost. The Cape Wind Project was approved. And so this is the next step. The turbines are causing health issues.
There is a sliver of plausibility here, and there are a couple of published studies, not really studies, more like analyses of, is this possible? And that is these really big wind turbines do cause infrasound.
Infrasound, yeah.
Yeah, and that could annoy, could annoy certain people.
So what
certain
is that, Steve? Could, isn't that warbly, like, flutter of air circulating?
Well, by definition, sound that's too low for your ears to hear.
It's like when trucks go over a freeway. I think that's probably the most common source that people get on a day-to-day basis. And it's been blamed for a huge number of problems, very few of which I've seen solidly supported by research. It's known as the brown note because it was rumored to cause some people to poop themselves which was studied. There's
That's
an actual
crazy.
Study where they played the brown note to a theater full of people listening to an orchestra. They were asked to rate certain songs, and during some songs they played the brown notes and others they did not. There were no cases
poop?
Of pooping.
Come on.
There were no cases of pooping.
The brown note is a lie.
Yeah. I mean, so with regard to wind turbine syndrome, they certainly do not have their ducks in a row. They haven't proven that people who think that they're sensitive can actually tell when or when they are or are not being exposed to an active wind turbine, that it is causing their symptoms, that there's a specific mechanism there, that their syndrome even can be identified, that it has any features that identify it as wind turbine syndrome. It's just nonspecific symptoms and supposition. That's all they got at this point in time. It's not impossible, crazy impossible, but chances of it actually turning out to be real are pretty small. And even if there is a minority of people who are sensitive to infrasound from wind turbines, that doesn't mean that it explains all cases. I think most cases probably are just people who have nonspecific symptoms and are looking for a cause. Or, as Rebecca says, it's a convenient excuse not to have a giant wind turbine in your
And I'm not saying that they're necessarily consciously doing that, even so. I do think that there could be a very good chance that someone has these nonspecific symptoms and they will naturally gravitate toward the thing that they hate. Not coming up with these symptoms as a way to get rid of the turbines, although maybe that would happen too.
Also, you know, these wind turbines are all over the world. I've seen them in Hawaii, I've seen them in Sweden. Personally, and
they're big in Australia. Yep.
Yeah, that's right, Ev. And a lot of other people around the world would be complaining about this. I find it hard to believe that the only people that are finding, you know, these symptoms are people that live near the ones in Nantucket.
So, Bob, you finally made it.
Yes.
Hey, Bob.
To the big time.
Bob's joining us now. So you're going to tell us about exoplanets. Not that we haven't talked about them before, but apparently we passed a bit of a milestone.
Yeah, we did. Do you guys remember in 1995 when, you know, when the news was released of that first confirmed exoplanet Discovery.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. Yeah. I remember.
I'm still reeling from it.
Yeah.
I don't believe I'm still.
95. The World Wide Web was just a little baby back then. It seems like so long ago.
World Wide what?
Yeah. Well, on October 22nd, 2013, that number officially surpassed 1,000 exoplanets. Confirmed. Well, confirmed within a reasonable degree. So that's news for celebration, I think. The last pulse of 11 planets, because they were at 999, the last grouping of 11 came from the UK's wide-angle search for planets known as WASP. Have you guys heard of this guy? It's amazing. It consists of two completely robotic observatories, each one observing a hemisphere 24/7, 365.24. Or pretty damn close. All the time, they're just checking out the skies, and they each have these 8 wide-angle cameras that can monitor millions of stars all at once, just waiting for one, you know, to move in front of a star, blocking some of its light. And that's obviously the transit method, and we've talked about that a bunch. But that's not the only way to spot exoplanets, and it's not the most prolific either. At the top of the heap is radial velocity. That's the most common. Most of these planets have been discovered this way. And the idea behind that is that as a star and a planet orbit around their center of mass, that resulting Doppler effect of the star moving towards us and then away can be seen in the spectral line. So you can infer the existence of the planet based on that. And then, of course, second most is the transit method, which I discussed. The planet eclipses the star, and the light dips, and if you can sense that pattern, you could infer as well that there's a planet there. And that's I couldn't get a number of how many of these 1,010 were discovered because of the transit method, but it's the second most popular way of finding them. Then there's a few more that I wasn't even aware they were using. There's gravitational microlensing. Microlensing is like putting a gargantuan lens deep in space. In this case, the lens is the gravitational field of the star acting like a lens, magnifying the light of a distant background star. Of course, whole galaxies or even clusters of galaxies can form this lens as well. But planets orbiting one of these lensing stars can cause weird stuff to happen to the magnified light. So if you examine that light and how it changes, then you can also infer that a planet must have been causing that. And there's been 13 detections to date using this gravitational microlensing method. There's pulsar timing. This one is interesting. Yes, pulsars can have planets. If they're close enough, these planets can cause tiny observable anomalies in the timing of the radio pulses that the pulsar emits. There you go. So far, we found about 5 planets using this pulsar timing method. And then one of the most interesting, I think, is the direct imaging, actually imaging the planet. And we've actually done that. It's extremely difficult, as you can imagine, mainly because a planet could be a millionth of the brightness of its parent star. So they found some planets using this method, which is pretty cool. Let's see. The last one I'll mention is the transit timing variation method. This is used for systems with multiple planets, and it's really interesting because these planets orbiting the star, they can slightly mess with each other's orbit. And the cool thing is that this can point to the presence of another planet that could be undetectable by other methods, like the transit method, for example. So this is a great way to figure out if there's other planets in the system where you've already discovered a planet and there's no other real good way to determine whether those planets are there. And they found a few planets using this method. There's been some estimates I've come across that there's 100 billion exoplanets out there orbiting their own Milky Way stars. That, of course, does not include the rogue planets we've talked about. And we've only spotted about a little over 1,000 of them. 17 billion of those 100 billion may be Earth-sized, and we've only found 11 of those. So clearly, there's so much more to discover out there. I found an interesting chart that segregated all the planets that were found based on their size. So in terms of Jupiter-sized, we found 711. Clearly, the lion's share have been these gargantuan Jupiter-sized exoplanets. That's 72%. Then the next category was Neptune-sized. They found 148 that are about Neptune-sized, 15%. And then there's the super-Earth, bigger than Earth, obviously. We found 100 of them, and that's 11%. And then there's the Earth-sized. We found 11 Earth-sized exoplanets. And, of course, they're probably the most interesting of all. But that's only 1% of the planets that we found. And, of course, there's a bias there because it's much easier to detect the bigger planets. So who knows what the real distribution is. Mars-sized, we found 7 of them. That's 7% of the total. And then Mercury-sized, we found only three, which is pretty interesting because that's they're so tiny, and that's only 0.3%.
You said Mars was 7 total. Isn't that 0.7%? No,
yes.
You said 7%.
Did I say 7? Sorry, I meant 0.7.
And then if Mercury was 3, yeah, it's 0.3%.
Yep. Good catch.
Yeah, okay.
So that these numbers, though, can go down, surprisingly, not just up. And there's two reasons why the number of exoplanets can go down. So one reason is that the whole idea of what a planet is still a little nebulous. And this is actually, though, the opposite of the Pluto problem, which was the smallest planet before it became a dwarf. Some exoplanets are so big that they may be promoted at some point in the future off the list because we may find that they actually are something like, say, brown dwarf stars. The other reason is that sometimes the data is misleading. When you look at the data and from another angle or using different filters or whatever, sometimes they disappear. The exoplanet's just like gone. Whoops. Sorry. Not there. And actually 10 have already been removed for this exact reason.
Oops.
Very depressingly, this may actually happen to Alpha Centauri B. Remember that one? It's considered the closest exoplanet, but
yeah.
doubt has recently been cast on its existence, and it may just be an artifact. So that would kind of stink.
Bob, what's your favorite exoplanet?
Well, it was Alpha Centauri B, but I don't know anymore.
Come on, it might not even exist.
Yeah.
What about Kepler 16b, the first circumbinary planet? Circles two stars.
Yeah. Very cool. That's excellent.
Cool.
But there's more depressing news. Abel Mendez, he's from the Planetary Habitability Laboratory at the University of Puerto Rico. He says that if it weren't for the lack of funding and telescopes, the number of exoplanets would be a lot higher than just 1,010. So he's kind of bummed. And, you know, as excited as he is, he's kind of like me. He just sees like, oh man, well, you know, what could have been? It could have been even a lot more.
Should we throw billions of dollars at this project, Bob?
Billions. I don't know about that. Hundreds of millions at least.
He considered it, Steve. <He's>
like, and then, of course, we've got the untimely death of the Kepler Space Telescope, which really was nasty. And it may seem that the rapid increase that we've experienced of exoplanets is a thing of the past, but it's not, I don't think. Remember that we still have over 3,200 cataloged objects from Kepler's database to go through. And WASP, of course, is still alive and well. And other experiments going on, you know, other studies going on as well. So that number will probably just slowly increase over time. Maybe not quite as fast without Kepler, because that guy just flew through them. But I'm sure we'll get another telescope to replace Kepler soon. So have a toast for the 1,000th or the 1,010th exoplanet discovered since 1995.
Well, Evan, it's time once again for Who's That Noisy?
Hey, it is time again. Thank you, Steve. So we'll get right to it, shall we? And we're going to play for you last week's Who's That Noisy? And here it is.
You haven't heard of the Millennium Falcon? It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs.
Wait, was that the recording?
All right.
That sounded different.
Yeah.
It was a little different, maybe.
Crisper.
It was much more eloquent and polished last week. What happened?
Yeah, I didn't like it last week, but this week. This week I like
hey
it.
Hey, now.
Oh,
hey,
what?
Now.
Is the clip still playing, Evan?
It might be. Hang on, let me find the off button. Damn it!
Turn it
broken.
Off. It's getting annoying.
It's broken.
Again.
Brian Mallow is joining us for Who's That Noisy this week. Brian, welcome to the Skeptics Guide.
Well, thanks. Great to be here. Thank you. And why am I here?
Because, of course, that was your voice last week. You're the answer to Who's That Noisy from last week.
I'm the answer. Let's just leave it at that. Whatever the question is, I'm the answer.
And that was from a YouTube video on Science of Star Wars.
Yes, the abuse of science in Star Wars.
The abuse of science in Star Wars, yeah. The old parsec thing bit.
Yes, which I got to say, you know, as I say in the clip, I love Star Wars. I love the movie. It was formative in my early teenage years. But I'm also not above, you know, overanalyzing like all geeks like to do, and also, you know, noticing when there's a science problem. It doesn't mean we don't like the. I made it so clear that I like it. I really thought Star Wars fans would like that clip because, like me, maybe they're geeks and they love the movie, but it's okay to point this out. But wow, not true. Turns out fans of the movie and fans of they're very unforgiving of the slightest criticism. They're very dogmatic. Yes, they might remind you of other people you enjoy talking about.
Well, I think there are different flavors because we're all science fiction Star Wars fans on the show here. And yeah, we absolutely love to nitpick little science errors because why not? You know, right. And it absolutely says nothing about how enjoyable it is as entertainment, as fiction. But I do think there is the flavor that want it to be pristine and don't want the criticism. So they do what you describe in your video as retroactive continuity.
Yes, retcon.
They make up shit to make it all make sense after the fact, which shows how creative human beings are at being able to do that. You could explain anything after the fact if you really try hard enough.
Right, you can. And it doesn't matter what the movie or book in question is. right?
Yeah, you made, in the video, you made the point that in the book, in the Star Wars book by George Lucas, there was a different line there, not parsecs.
Well, I mean, it's the exact same line. And my point was, you know, the question is, did he mean, you know, he uses parsecs and that's, he uses it like it's a unit of time, but it's actually a unit of distance. So in the book, it says, you haven't heard of the Millennium Falcon. It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 standard time parts. So that would indicate that they did mean time parts, which is a misuse of the word. So that would go to support my argument there. And then, but the other part of it is, wow, standard time parts? That's terrible writing. Like, who would write? What happened there? Is this the same guy that invented Wookiees and the Death Star and Jedi Knights and the Force and lightsabers? And then just what? The He ran dry. He just had nothing. It's like a standard, like we're supposed to believe this is a civilization that never named their basic unit of time.
I know that Lucas got a lot of things right as far as, you know, good writing and cool ideas, but he proved without a shadow of a doubt that he's not a good writer. So we know that he, you know, that was strangely one of the few really bad mistakes that he made, because when you look at episodes 1, 2, and 3, they suck so bad.
Oh man.
That it's impossible that he wrote Star Wars.
And you know, I know that's the really hard thing. And the other thing that was heartbreaking is that at that point, he could have hired the best writers in the world to make those next movies. And why didn't he? Or maybe he thought he was, but those just didn't turn out to be, they just could have been something
else.
Because
Brian, that's the shit that he likes. That's actually what he thinks is the best.
Yeah. It doesn't, yeah. And I gotta say, that's not necessarily my point of view. Those movies, those first ones were so good. They were so important.
Of course. They're epic. Are you kidding me? I have a DL-44 in my house right now. I'm with you on that.
Look, he had to build the technology from scratch. I mean, out of spare parts in the backyard, basically, to make some of those special effects work in the first movie. He reinvented, I guess, how science fiction movies were made. So he, technologically, very important to the industry.
He betrayed all of us. Okay.
that just makes the betrayal even worse, doesn't it? Because he was like that.
Well, it's a lost potential. Those first three movies could have been so good. And it's not like, and you're right, like from the time I was 13 years old, I was imagining the prequels. And the fabulous story that happened before all of this, and how awesome it must have been with the Empire and all the Jedi and all their glory and the Sith Lords. And then it sucked. It was such a letdown. I mean, because my imagination was already leaps and bounds beyond the crap that ended up on that screen.
Yeah,
guys, do you remember who was that guy on YouTube? I remember I watched it and I was very disappointed, and I don't think I've watched them since, you know? I have not even watched them again, which is a little bit pathetic because it is Star Wars and visually they were still fantastic. But then I watched a YouTube video series, some guy dissecting the first movie to the, I forget who he was, I'd love to credit him, but he brought up stuff.
Huh? That's Plinkett Reviews from Red Letter.
Oh my God!
Yeah, Red Letter Media. Those are great.
It was amazing. He picked out stuff that I had no idea how stupid it was, and boy, now I think it's even stupider. So don't watch that YouTube show if you want to be even more pissed off at Lucas.
Yeah, but Jar Jar Binks was a great idea.
Oh my God! You know the thing that got me about that first one too is that they had Anakin as such a little kid, and that was so stupid, and it would have been very nice if it paralleled the original storyline by having Anakin start at about Luke's age, when we first meet Luke. That would have been nice. You didn't have to make him. I think a friend of mine and I discussed that it seems like there's this idea that when you're when your target audience is a young audience, that you all of a sudden there's this feeling that you have to make heroes that are young kids. But, you know, we all grew up with heroes being like adult Superman and Batman. They didn't have to be little kids. They were Spider-Man, and they were, you know, this idea that the heroes need to be little kids is yeah.
It makes me question when the movie came out and I saw the kid and I got the vibe of the kid and I'm like, okay, you could have found a much cooler kid. Like, the kid was adorable and everything, but like, I can't, you know, it had to be kind of like Batman as a kid. Like, even he has to be tough and cool in his own way because of what he becomes. That kid was so soft.
Yeah.
He was such a you know, made out of marshmallow that he could never become Darth Vader. The kid had to be intriguing, and they didn't do it. And then you also think, you know, is the kid in the movie because he wants kids to go to the movie? Like, I can't help but think those things. Like,
I know.
Did he really want Jar Jar Binks, or was Jar Jar Binks in there just for the kids? Like, get out of here.
But then it was so misguided, because then those movies have really complicated political stuff that couldn't be of any interest to kids. Like, it's like, it was
boring as hell. I fell asleep during the first one, and so I never went back. I never saw any of the other ones.
Oh, yeah. You didn't miss anything. What you missed were densely layered CGI effects, you know?
What I figured I missed was George Lucas taking a baseball bat to my childhood. Why? I don't need that. I don't need that. I'm already seeing bronies do it. I didn't need to see George Lucas do it.
Evan, to get back on track a little bit before we go too far down this rabbit hole, did anybody get that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, how about you tell us who this week's winner was?
Well, this week's winner is Marcus Gilman. So congratulations, Marcus. Your name will go into the drawing at the end of the year. And if the SGU draws your name, Marcus, you will win the grand prize, which is joining the Rogues to play science or fiction on an upcoming SGU episode in 2014. So there you go.
Also, a date with Brian Mallow.
Hey.
And he'll tell you all about Star Wars.
Yeah. Best date ever.
Maybe some of that will be edited out. Best date ever.
Evan, do you have anything new for this week?
Absolutely, we do. And also, Brian, if you wouldn't mind, and go ahead and tell the audience what's in store for this week.
All right.
Brian,
well, I am
dirty work.
It's okay, Brian.
this is the first
time we've ever had a special guest be part of our Who's That Noisy segment.
And you're going to milk
allow
it.
I'm going to allow the guest to get into the pilot seat.
I'm the first guest presenter of Who's That Noisy.
You are. So first history is being made right now.
First and possibly last. So this week we have a puzzle. Please remember that our puzzles always have to do with science or skepticism, and this week's puzzle is no exception. So here we go. You might want to get a pen. I'm not going to stop and wait for you, because this is not live radio. It's a file, and you can stop it and rewind it. But get a pen and identify this sequence. 7.5, 7, 7.5, 10, 8.5, 4, 9, 6.5, 9, 6, 8, and finally 5.5. And I will give you one hint. The number of numbers is significant. So give it your best guess and email your answer to WTN@theskepticsguide.org, or you can join the message boards and post your answer there at sguforums.com. And as Evan says every week, good luck, everyone.
I don't know, Evan. You got to be careful here. Brian might be the new Evan.
Yeah, I feel like we should make Brian an offer here.
Brian.
Hey, Brian, I got to ask you. So out of the three Star Wars movies, what is your favorite moment, scene or piece of dialogue or whatever?
Wow. I thought you were just going to ask favorite movie, and I was even going to have to waffle on that, because Star Wars is Star Wars, but Empire Strikes Back was such a cool science fiction movie that it's even hard to pick between those two, and those aren't the only two choices. We all know that. But,
come on. It's I Am Your Father. All right.
No, what? Come on. There's Ewoks. Who didn't love those Ewoks?
Oh, I did not like
Ewoks.
I had the Ewok village.
Whose jaw did not hit the ground? Luke, I am your father. It's so iconic now. Awesome.
I know. But you know what? There was one thing that rings into my childhood all the way down to my feet. Like, this is like so iconic for me. When Luke's theme is being played and he's looking at the two sunset.
Yeah.
Yeah, you and every 12-year-old girl, Jay.
Jay, you lied. Jay, you told me it was a lay in a bikini. What are you talking about?
No, that's a pretty beautiful moment. That, you know, for, and also it's not just, you know, because it's a binary star system and you're like, oh, the awe of science is in there. And it's like, you can't help but, you know, as a science fiction fan my whole life, there's, I always dreamed of the things that I read about and you'd like stargaze and look up and I always thought, I was always a little saddened by the fact that I just know some of the stuff. I had an optimistic view of humans, you know, future here and thinking, maybe that was reading Asimov and Clark. And, so it wasn't cynical. And I believe that much of this stuff will happen one day, but it'll be beyond my life span. So it's like, it was always that, oh man, this is going to happen, but I'm not going to live to see it. So that dual sun, I don't know. That's an awesome moment.
Because Darth Vader was so evil in Empire Strikes Back. I mean, he was at his darkest at those moments. He was just killing his own officers and things. I thought it was fantastic. I really, really got into that movie more than the others.
Yeah. Yeah. He was great in that movie, which made the first ones all the more disappointing.
Yeah. Plus he had a different director for the second movie.
And that's another movie.
Yeah. One that sticks out, Jay, was the first close up of the Death Star and you saw the scope and size of it. And when the Millennium Falcon was docking and you could see how gargantuan that, to me, that was pretty epic to think a space station the size of a moon.
Right. That stands out. Moon. That's a space station.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't say one. I can't pick one. Those two movies have so much, I think, that
maybe it's my age, but I grew up just assuming space stations were the size of moons. Because I'm clearly pretty sure I saw Star Wars before I saw a space station.
All right, I'll give you one scene nobody's mentioned. When they walk into the cantina and those aliens are there.
Yes. Yeah, of course. That might be number one right there.
Brian, so before we go into the next science fiction movie, tell us about your career. You are a science comedian. What is that?
What is that, really? I mean, it's rare funny that guys, nobody ever asks what a political comedian is, but I do get some weird science comedian, and people either immediately are excited by that idea or they're very filled with dread, total dread. I can't tell you how many times people have told me that, and they're like, what? Because maybe you've heard someone try to be funny in science, and it wasn't funny. It was painful. But, you know, I was doing stand-up comedy for a long time before I narrowed it down to that. It was always, I liked science and science fiction much earlier than stand-up comedy. So it was pretty natural when I started doing comedy that I drew from that. It was like, I have a geeky background. So it was very natural for me right out the gate to make science references and use the language of science for color, even if the topic wasn't science, or use some little tidbit, some little science fact. So that was all very natural for me to do. And so I was always doing it. And it just took the longest time for me to realize that I should just focus on that and cut the other stuff away and just go, oh, this science comedian.
No, it's brilliant. I mean, science, there's so much comedic potential there.
And yeah.
Especially if you get the inside jokes. And
yeah, and you know,
really
there's
funny.
The way I do it, I guess I have to come up with a definition, but I actually do a couple different things because I perform for specialized groups. I'll perform for groups of scientists, and you can do it one way where you can, you know, make use of their special language and knowledge and make references and not have to explain them, but count on them getting it. And then I perform for general audiences, in which case you can still talk about, like, I guess there's two kinds of general audiences. One is not that general. They came for science comedy. So I'm also counting on them knowing some of the stuff I know, but I'm not a scientist. So if you know, you might know the stuff I know because you just love, you're an enthusiast like me. And then there's might be people that aren't quite the enthusiasts. And I think I have plenty of stuff for them that it's funny stuff that I did in nightclubs and it could work with any audience. And maybe it'll make people laugh and go, hey, science isn't that scary. Or he actually made me laugh, even though he was a geek.
Hey, Brian, I see here you serve on the advisory board for the USA Science and Engineering Festival.
Is that correct? Science festivals are something that's been going on in Europe and in the UK for a lot longer than it has here. But over the past several years, more and more have popped up and they're becoming more popular. And I got involved with one in San Diego several years ago when it was like the first one. And then this USA festival came. So it's really fun for me. It's a place where people come to celebrate science. Of all the things we celebrate in our culture, we don't celebrate science enough. And we sure spend enough time celebrating Hollywood achievements and sports achievements. And as I sometimes say, we wouldn't even be able to celebrate those things if it weren't for the science and technology that allows us to have those stadiums and those live satellite programs and brought to our into our living rooms with television. You know, of all the things that science makes possible, we don't celebrate science itself. There's one going on right now in San Francisco. I think it's still going on. There's one here in the Triangle, this area in North Carolina where I live, around Raleigh and Durham and Chapel Hill. There's been a fairly long running one in the Cambridge Science Festival, I think, that's in, you know, the MIT area. All these science organizations and big corporations like Boeing or someone might have booths. And, like in the case of the National Academies, we did some stuff where I kind of interviewed some scientists on stage. We actually played a couple rounds of What's My Line, where I had a scientist on stage and we let the audience ask yes or no questions to try to hone in on what their career was or what their research was.
So Brian, it was really a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for helping us out with Who's That Noisy?
Oh, yeah. Anytime.
And hopefully our paths will cross again. I'm sure they will in the future.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It was fun.
Thanks, Brian. You too, bud.
Thanks, Brian.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes, sir.
The day is mine.
All right, here we go. Three regular news items this week. Item number one, a computer engineer has developed an algorithm to restore a digital image from as little as 1% of the original information. Item number two, a new study finds that younger siblings may contain cells with the DNA of their older siblings. And item number three, researchers find that eucalyptus trees concentrate gold in their leaves and in some areas represent a significant source of the mineral. Bob, go first.
Bastard. damn. See, an algorithm to just restore a digital image. 1%. Yeah, that sounds impressive as hell. It obviously is. Now, I'm sure if it's like, 100 pixels, he's not going to do it. But if it's, you know, if it's more of a diffuse, tiny percentage of the original, I can kind of imagine how they could do it. Yeah, you just say restore. I'm not sure if you're implying to restore it as it was with really good fidelity or not, but, I'm sure they could restore a vague semblance of the original from 1%, still, that's low as hell. That's impressive. Younger siblings may contain cells with the DNA of their older sibling. What? Come on. Really? Maybe this is some cell contained in the uterus? Oh, God. Wow. I don't know. Okay. Let's look at the third one. Eucalyptus trees concentrating gold. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I can't think of anything that jumps out at me that says it's bullshit. Significant source of the mineral. All right. I'm going to say eucalyptus. Fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Oh God. You know, like when you think you have like some type of expertise in the field, like, you know, things with computers and stuff, I have a lot of experience. I'm looking at this and I'm like, so an engineer developed an algorithm that can restore a digital image from as little as 1% of the original information. Like that on the surface can't possibly be true. If you cut away 99% of the information, then what are you restoring up to? Because you know, how do you expand on that 1%? The only way to do it would be is if it were compressed. So this is very puzzling to me that Steve would even bring this up because it seems so obvious that it's wrong. So that one I'm not sure about. The second one about the siblings, you know, finding cells from your older siblings, that one is science, I believe. So this third one here, they find that there's gold in them thar eucalyptus trees. So if you drink the concentrate from a eucalyptus tree, if you drink it, you are drinking gold. And everybody knows that I love gold. God damn, Steve, this is a hard one, because that first one, I'm going to be so pissed about the decision I'm about to make if I'm wrong. But I think I'm going to go with the eucalyptus tree as the fake.
Okay. Evan?
Restoring a digital image from as little as 1% of the original information, I would think that that has to do with depends what the image originally was. If it's something basic, if it's something not too complex, perhaps you could use as little as 1% of the original information to extrapolate the rest of the missing data. So I'm thinking that one's right. The next one about DNA. Wow. How does that happen? What could that possibly be? So you've got this older kid. They've got their DNA. It's left, maybe leftovers inside.
Leftovers. The There's some, I don't know. Pot roast. Got a couple
a
of
little takeout box.
Your older brother Bob is left over here for you.
How long's that been in there?
Okay. If you don't eat it, I'm going to throw it away.
But, like Jay and Bob, I'm having a difficult time with the gold in the leaves of the eucalyptus trees. How the heck would it get in there? Why? I wonder if there are examples of, well, okay, so fish have mercury, so I guess you can have,
You ever hear of gold leafing, Evan? Come on.
Yes. There you go. Yeah, there is. Good point. Very good.
Nice, Jay.
I don't know how this younger siblings thing, it's absolutely baffling. I have no idea what's going on there. I'll say the DNA of the older siblings one is the fiction.
And Rebecca.
The very little I have to add to this is that my first thought was that the restoring an image from 1% seemed actually like the most plausible of these three to me at first. And maybe that's naivete, maybe that's one too many episodes of Law and Order, SVU, CSI.
CSI. Yeah.
enhance. But yeah, it certainly, like Evan says, I think with a simple picture of some sort, but actually maybe, I don't know, maybe a more complex. So for me, it was between the DNA and the eucalyptus. The only thing I could think about the DNA thing is that I have heard of theories, some hypotheses that, that older siblings can possibly influence younger siblings in terms of how much testosterone and certain hormones they get from the mother. But I don't know how that would play with DNA. It seems ridiculous. It seems crazy to me. But when I'm down to two items and one seems completely off the wall, that usually means that that's the science. So the gold in the leaves, I can imagine there being golden eucalyptus tree leaves because they're a plant. They absorb things from the soil. The soil has certain amounts of metals in them. But representing a significant source of the mineral, that sounds really fishy to me. So I'm going to go with that one as the fake as well.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Evan.
All right. Evan's all by himself. So that means you all agree that a computer engineer has developed an algorithm to restore a digital image from as little as 1% of the original information. That one is science.
Damn, I'm so happy and angry at the same time.
Details,
it's
please.
It's a PhD thesis. Daniel Paternayne Dallow, computer engineer of the University of Navarre. So he developed an algorithm to optimize and reduce an image to between 1 and 10% of the original information and allow a 100% restore of the original image.
Oh, I wasn't. Oh, you bastard. I wasn't looking at it from that. Like, so you're talking about he compresses it.
The algorithm was developed so that if a digital image is either partially lost or damaged, that it can be restored to its original based upon this being run previously through this algorithm. The information stored in that algorithm itself would only be between 1 and 10% of the size of the image. It's the original image. But it worked so well that they discovered that you could lose even 100% of the image. And basically, yeah, when first I read that, it's like, you could lose 100% of the image and still restore it. So in other words, you could restore it entirely from the previously stored algorithm, without having any bit of the image, the original image, itself. In that respect, it does work like a compression, you know, where you're essentially storing the information of the original image in 1% because of some kind of algorithm that can represent all of that information.
Yeah, so it's a phenomenal compression of an image. It's a compressed version that the guy, what he figured out how to do is compress something down to 1% the size of the original image.
In the final analysis, yes, that's what.
Thank you. All right, moving on.
All right.
Wow.
Yeah, I think that
no, Bob, I said yeah, thank you. It. Moving on. Thank you.
Good day, sir. Good day, sir. I said good day.
Good day.
I said good day.
You'll find your hat by the door.
All right, number two. A new study finds that younger siblings may contain cells with the DNA of their older siblings. Science. Evan thinks this one is the fiction. Jay thinks that he has cells from Bob and me circling around his body somewhere.
Gross.
I know where my cells are.
Too many
are.
Gross jokes.
And this one is science.
Uh-oh.
Science.
I knew
Evan.
It.
Yeah, baby.
This was this study that established that it was in dogs, but the same thing should apply for people. Essentially, in the process of birth, cells from the fetus stay behind in the mother. And those cells can be then transferred to later siblings and actually survive. It actually does mean that Jay could have some cells surviving in his body that have the DNA from either Bob or I.
Awesome.
Lucky bastard.
Isn't that cool? All right, let's go on. Number three, researchers find that eucalyptus trees concentrate gold in their leaves and in some areas represent a significant source of the mineral. This one is fiction. This item was getting around a little bit, so you know, I didn't want to use it as a straight-up science. Which of you guys saw this news item?
I did not see it.
No.
Oh, nope. Man, I thought for sure you guys would have seen it. So
it sounds like one of those things where I'm glad I didn't see it. Cause,
well, yeah. I mean, yeah so right. I was hoping that you would have seen it and then not have read carefully enough.
Those are the most annoying.
They are the worst.
What it's like, yeah, I read it. I got this one down. Like, what? I read it and I still got it wrong?
So researchers have found eucalyptus trees with gold in the leaves. But it's in tiny amounts, not insignificant, not a source of the mineral.
Uh-huh.
That was the bit that was fiction. Oh.
So koala bears are high on gold. Is that what you're saying?
Gold.
Wow. You so rarely make an adjustment to the item based on quantity.
Yeah, but that's significant though. That's not just a number amount. That's from an insignificant amount to like an actual source of the mineral. Yeah. No. So the trees are bringing the gold up from pretty deep underground through their root system. As
yeah,
far as
I
like 10 meters underground, they say, or tens of meters. Ooh. And, the gold particles are extruded in the leaves as a way of getting rid of them because they don't want the gold to build up in the tree itself because then it would become toxic. While this isn't a significant source of gold, they said that it would require something like 50 acres of eucalyptus trees in order to get the amount of gold that would be comprised in a ring, like Lord of the Rings.
Thanks.
Steve. Oh, a ring like
yes,
that.
Just
thanks.
To clarify.
Because before that, I never would have thought
like,
a ring was.
Oh, like the one ring. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's worth it then.
So not a practical source of gold.
Tremendous.
Steve, would you be able to control like koala bears at that point if you had that ring?
You could. That's right. So, but think about it. So you know how this would be useful? You could use this as a way of finding gold mines. Because this only occurs when the trees are above a significant source of gold. So rather than having to drill down and find out where the gold is, you just sample the eucalyptus tree leaves. And when you find a patch that has gold in the leaves, boom, that's where you dig.
Bingo.
That's awesome.
Do you know that this guy made an algorithm where you can compress down a eucalyptus tree down to 1%?
And get some DNA from your brother
out of it.
That's
right. It's awesome.
All right, then, Jay, give us a quote.
Okay, this week's quote was sent in by a listener named Brian R. Page, and the quote is actually a law. And the law states, the pursuit of balance can create imbalance because sometimes something is true. And that quote is actually authored by a man named Daniel Okrent. And of course, you can understand, you know, what he's talking about. You know, skeptics face this stuff all the time that, this idea of balance when there really isn't balance, in particular when we talk about issues with science versus pseudoscience, you know, we don't need to hear what the homeopaths have to say. It's irrelevant.
Yeah, we call that false balance. And yeah, but I didn't know false balance had a name attached to it, Okrent's Law. And he was specifically referring to the media, providing legitimacy to fringe or minority viewpoints. Looks like that was probably said somewhere in the 1970s. Yeah, so I guess that idea of false balance has been around for a long time. It's cool.
Daniel Okrid!
All right, thanks, Jay. Couple of quick announcements this week. Jay, you're going to tell us about some pathogen cards.
Yeah, a friend of ours named Todd, frustrated with the success of the anti-vax movement and also the idea that vaccines have been so widely successful that many people don't know much about the diseases that vaccines actually prevent. You know, what they can do, what they look like. You know, imagine the horrible idea of someone getting getting something that a vaccine could have prevented, some crazy disease that would debilitate you or kill you. You know, Todd thought it would be an interesting thing to make up these like cards that represent each of the diseases, but these are more like mugshot cards. You know, that's the joke, that the cards are displayed in such a way where you get a quick view of what they are and you get to see a picture of what the virus actually looks like that causes all of these diseases. So he designed them poster size originally, but then realized, you know, he could turn these into like a set of cards. And now he has 16 of them, and he did an initial printing of them. And then he had given away and sold so many of them that, he ended up making another printing of them. And these are actually really cool. And the reason why I'm mentioning them is because, I like the idea of people understanding more about these types of diseases and, you know, what causes them and learn a little bit more about all the different things, not just the big obvious ones, but all the different things that vaccines treat. So the URL, if you're interested to look at these cards or to purchase them. So the tiny URL is tinyurl.com/KEMWSXG, or you can go to the show notes to get to the real URL and take a look.
Yeah, you know, Todd gave us a bunch of these cards, Jay, last time we were together. I think this is when we were at Nexus when he showed them to us for the first time. So what we can do is if you purchase anything from the SGU store, just go to the website and go to the store. You see lots of swag there, t-shirts, pens, SGU pins, or SGU keychains, etc. We'll include a pathogen card in each order until we run out of them. I have a quick announcement as well. So next month, November 22nd and 23rd, I will be in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm going to be there for a headache conference. But while I'm there, I'll be free in the evening. So any of the local skeptics want to organize a get together, I'll be happy to make time in my schedule. We could do a Q&A, just a meet and greet, or I can give a talk, or we could just do dinner. Whatever you want, contact me. We'll organize something and then I'll announce the details in the next week or two once we firm them up.
They have conferences about headaches?
Sure. Headache is a subspecialty of neurology.
Do they have t-shirts that say, like, you know, I kick a headache's ass or something?
I don't know. I'll let you know when I go to the conference.
Okay.
I'm actually board certified in the headache subspecialty. So one last announcement. So next Wednesday, that's Wednesday, October 30th, day before Halloween, we'll be recording our next show, and we will be recording it using GoToMeeting with all of the five of us on video, and we are going to invite 15 of our listeners to join us for the conference. We will send you the link to join the GoToMeeting, and although you won't be able to show video, the listeners will be audio only. All of the rugs will be audio and video. We'll do a Q&A section, so at some point you'll be able to ask us questions. Most of the time, though, you'll just be listening in as we record a usual show, including hearing all of the between and background stuff that usually gets edited out. This is going to be on a first-come, first-served basis. However, it's also going to be prioritized by membership level. So this is partly also going to be a perk to our members. In other words, the higher levels will take priority over the lower levels. So we'll just take the first 15 from the top down. And if we get to the same level, then it'll be by whoever we got first. If you've already sent us a request, because I did let our members know about this ahead of time, I can't count that because I didn't formally ask for people to send in their requests. We're doing that now. So send it in again. Email us at info@theskepticsguide.org and include GoToMeeting recording in the subject line so we'll know what it is about. And then we will accept requests through midnight on Mondays, Eastern time, Monday. And then that way on Tuesday, we can send out the emails to the 15 people that we're going to invite to join us. for recording 8 p.m. Eastern Time. You need to have headphones. You can't listen in over speakers. And a microphone if you want to ask questions. So should be fun. This is a bit, you know, bear with us. This is the first time we're doing something like this. So it's a little bit experimental. We don't know how the bandwidth and everything is going to work. So no promises as to quality. And then we'll let everybody know how it went. And if it goes well, we plan on doing more of these in the future. So there will be other opportunities to do this.
Yeah, because it's our first time and we're testing it, I think we should also just let everyone know there might be the idea that we have to cancel the whole thing at the last minute just because we have to record the show. And if it's like not working, it's killing somebody's internet or whatever, just be prepared and we'll try to figure it out and make it up to you next time.
Yeah, this is definitely the first time experiment, so no promises, but it should go fine. I'm not anticipating we'll have to cancel the whole thing, but yeah, we got to leave our options open. All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Steve, thank you. It was incredible.
Except for science fiction, it was great.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.